From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Just a couple of days after Seymour Hersh reported that the U.S. has intensified planning for a possible air attack against Iran, Iran announced that it succeeded in enriching uranium. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Hersh about his story in this week's New Yorker on military plans the Bush administration is considering to stop Iran from developing a nuclear weapon. Also, we talk with director Mary Harron about her new movie, The Notorious Betty Page. It's based on the life of the 50s pinup queen, who has been described as the first official pinup of the bondage scene. Page's life was filled with mysteries and contradictions. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It was just a couple of days ago that my guest Seymour Hersh reported in The New Yorker that the Bush administration has intensified planning for a possible major air attack against Iran to stop its nuclear program. Yesterday, the president of Iran announced Iran has joined the nuclear countries of the world. It has succeeded in enriching uranium. Although Iran says it's for nuclear power, the international community believes Iran is working on nuclear weapons in defiance of the United Nations. Seymour Hersh won a Pulitzer Prize for breaking the story of the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. In 2004, he broke the story of abuses in Abu Ghraib prison. I asked him if yesterday's announcement by the Iranian president put Hersh's current New Yorker report in a new light.
The fact is that what he said yesterday was old hat. They've already done that before. They have successfully enriched uranium in a small pilot project, and that's what they did yesterday. They ran a string of 164 centrifuges, which was more complicated. They ran it for a certain number of hours. There's a great deal of skepticism in the American intelligence community, also among our allies, and also among the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, offices in Vienna, as to how competent the Iranians are in all of this. They're certainly years and years away from being able to master the process of enriching uranium at a large scale, thousands and thousands of centrifuges running constantly. You have to do that to generate enough uranium to make a weapon. So they're not there yet.
Now, you report in The New Yorker that the Bush administration has intensified planning for a possible attack. You know, newspapers around the world have been summarizing your article, but I'm going to ask you to give us a very brief summary for anyone who hasn't yet read your article or read the summary of it.
Well, the one part the newspapers and previous interviews I've done, have gotten wrong is, not wrong, it's just an emphasis. They keep on saying, the article says that Bush is planning to use tactical nuclear weapons in Iraq. What has happened, of course, is that there's always contingency planning. This is a staple of any major superpower. We do contingency planning for everything. In the last recent period, the planning's become operational. It's gone to the next phase, which is far more than just some vague contingency planning on a shelf. They're specifically drawing up target lists, and as I wrote in the article, we've sent teams of Americans undercover to begin to acquire what kind of information we need on the ground about the targets we may be bombing from the air. And so it's really escalating. That doesn't mean the president has decided to go to war, but it's put everything up a notch. As part of that planning, the military, when they're asked by the president to destroy something, give them a panoply of options. One of the major facilities that we know about, and I should add that much of what Iran does in the nuclear business, we don't know much about. Our intelligence isn't perfect. But the one place we have a fix on is called Natanz, where the enrichment that the Iranians announced yesterday took place. It's an underground bunker complex, quite big, 75 feet underground under hard rock, a little less than a few hundred miles away from Tehran. In order to successfully bomb that, the president was told, we can guarantee 100% destruction with a TAC nuke. That was in a paper. A few weeks or so afterwards, the Joint Chiefs realizing that this is, you know, perhaps even all along knowing that was just an option and wacko, you don't want to start using nuclear weapons in the Middle East against a Muslim country, went back to the White House and said, let's get this out of our plan. They tried to walk it back out. The White House then said, no, you profited, let's keep it in there. At this point, there was a lot of tension among some generals and admirals. I can't say everybody, but among some about this, simply because they do not want the nuclear option in the package.
Why not? Is this like a crossing a line that's been taboo until now?
It's a lot of complicated reasons. One would be among many military people, it's, believe it or not, real men don't use nukes. You know, we go out and get them hand to hand or whatever. The distinction between nukes and bombs is a little, there is one, they see. Secondly, there's a huge disconnect. We're seeing signs of it now in public. Various generals and these three generals, two Army guys and a Marine, in the last few weeks writing very critical essays about Rumsfeld. There's a huge disconnect between the military leadership and the civilian leadership in the Pentagon. That's for sure. The civilians in the Pentagon, many of what we would call neoconservatives, very hardliners, American Enterprise School, the guys that brought us Ahmed Shalabi, that crowd is still there. There's also a huge disconnect, I'm learning, between this, many of the senior leaders and the White House. And so, therefore, the military guys simply wanted this option. And there's also an ethical sense that you don't even plan or talk about using a nuclear weapon in this kind of a situation. We're talking about a preemptive, unilateral targeting of another country that isn't nuclear at this point, isn't a direct threat. This changes the equation. Why would you want to even get into this kind of thinking as a superpower, particularly when there are other powers in the country, in the world, six or seven other nuclear powers? Why do you want to decide that because you're the nuclear power, you can target anybody? So they tried to walk it back, as I said. If what I wrote, and things may change because there's a tremendous amount of heat on this because of this article on the institution. Believe me, there is, inside. But the chairman or one of the senior officials in the Joint Chiefs was going to do a paper, take it to the president, and insist that, and basically give him a formal recommendation that nuke planning should be off the board. At that point, the president would have no option. It's believed, but to go along, you can't countermand what the military tells you directly. And if the president still insisted on keeping the nuclear option in the planning, guys were saying they would resign, not necessarily publicly, but they would resign. It just may mean taking retirement early, but they would get out of there.
Is it your impression that most of the military leaders now are opposed to the use of a tactical nuclear weapon in Iran?
I just can't say that. I have a very small window. I talk to people. But you have to understand, the people I talk to, I've known some of them for decades, and the people I talk to are inside. They're very loyal to the United States. They're loyal to the military, the function of the military. They're almost idealistic. They're troubled by this government as much as many of the people on the outside are. They're troubled about the president's inability to cope with the reality about Iraq. They don't want Iran to go nuclear, but they don't know why the president is choosing now to say, as he has said repeatedly in public, that if Iran crosses a red line, and the president's red line is simply what the Iranians announced they did yesterday, any enrichment of uranium, he said, is a red line. He's also said in the last few weeks that even gaining the knowledge of the bomb is a red line. And he's also, in the last few weeks, repeatedly said all options are on the table. That is, he and the vice president, Mr. Cheney, also said that. All options are on the table. The bellicosity out of America is stunning. It inevitably results in the Iranians concluding that the faster we can get going on this nuclear business, the better off we are, because these guys are coming.
You write that there's a growing conviction among members of the U.S. military and in the international community that President Bush's ultimate goal in the nuclear confrontation with Iran is regime change. And one former defense official said the military planning was based on a belief that a sustained bombing campaign in Iran will humiliate the religious leadership and lead the public to rise up and overthrow the government. And I'm wondering how the problems we're having in Iraq now and the loss of confidence that the American public has in the war, and the fact that Iraq seems to be either in or on the verge of civil war, seems to be affecting the Bush administration thinking on the use of force in Iran. Did any of your sources talk to you about that, about how what's happening in Iraq is figuring into plans for Iran?
Well, one obvious, very indirect response or reaction to the complete debacle in Iraq is that people are talking to me so straightforwardly about the planning on Iran. And in other words, nobody wants to get us into the senior military guys who are perfectly aware how bad things are. And if you remember John Murtha, the congressman from Pennsylvania, last, I think, November, went public with a very stunning statement because he's such a conservative. And so known to be so military, he's a ranking member of the House Appropriations Defense Subcommittee, which he handles the money for the budget for the Pentagon. When he said what he said, the war is over, we got to get out, he was reflecting because he is known to me and to some of my people I know, my friends, as the insider. He's the one man that the generals, the four stars, the Joint Chiefs and others talk to privately. In other words, they come and let down their hair. When he said what he said, he was reflecting really the view. And it, of course, the next rush you heard was the rush of the Democrats running away from him, his own party. And nobody wanted to be associated with that, which is stunning. We'll deal with Congress some other time in our life. But in any case, They know it's basically a lose-lose in Iraq, and they don't want to see it replicated in Iran. So that's one result. I also think if you're a president, I have been told, I haven't written this, but I have been told that one of the major reasons we're fighting so hard to get rid of Jafari, the Shiite leader who's been, who won more votes and should be the prime minister of Iraq, the reason we're lobbying so hard to the point that even Jack Straw, the British foreign minister, and Condoleezza Rice, our secretary of state, went publicly there the other week to endorse another candidate, Made. One reason is Jafari's going to call for our withdrawal. He's going to, if he becomes prime minister, he's now the leading candidate for the job. He's won the most votes. If he gets in office, he's going to ask for us to get out. So if you're George Bush and you're looking towards a summer in which you're going to explain to the American people why after 3 years, perhaps $1 trillion, 2,500 lives, 2,400 lives anyway, five died yesterday. The death toll in Iraq's growing enormously. It's been a very bad month for American military men there. He has to explain to the American people why we're being told to get out. I can understand politically the attractiveness of declaring you're gonna go after this mouthy Iranian president who's always threatening Israel and his nuclear weapon system. That would be seen as perhaps by the White House as a plus, a political plus.
My guest is investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. We're talking about his article in The Current New Yorker. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is investigative journalist Seymour Hersh. His article in The Current New Yorker says that the Bush administration is intensifying planning for a possible major air attack against Iran. Now, there's been a lot of responses to your report in The New Yorker that the Bush administration is planning for an attack against Iran. Responses include that there are plans on the table, sure. Every conceivable plan is on the table. That doesn't mean we're seriously considering doing it. In the New York Times today, there's a report that at the Pentagon and elsewhere in the administration, officials say the prospect of military action remains remote in the short term and highly problematic beyond that. Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld has simply said, it's simply not useful to get into fantasy land, your article basically being fantasy land. Do any of these reactions jive with the impressions you've gotten from how serious the planning is?
The planning is totally serious, and it's operational planning, and people across the board, not only inside the American military, inside the political establishment, I quote a senior member of the House Appropriations Committee as saying that the president has begun briefing various, mostly conservative members of Congress about his plans and getting their support. This is going on, but let me say, Terry, that the purpose in people talking to me about this, and this whole issue came up a few months ago among people I've known for many years, if my story works, the precise things you're hearing now will be the result. The people talked to me in the hopes that if it was taken public, I literally told one of the people who started telling me about what was going on and the fear they had of this messianic president is going to do something, and I said to this one gentleman I've known for many years, in a sense, I said, what the hell do you want me to do about it? I can't write a speculative story. And he said, go to Vienna, talk to the IAEA, find out how far away they are. This is an issue that doesn't have to be raised now. Go to work and do it. And so I did, because there was no question, there is no question today, that this president, not in the back of the mind, in the front, right there, wants to do something. He wants to do something about Iran. I quoted people in the article as saying he views Ahmadinejad, the Iranian president, as an Adolf Hitler. He sees this Iran as Germany, Nazi Germany in 1935. That's the analogy that they use in the White House. I've heard two different people tell me that analogy who meet there. And so when you have this sort of a situation, in other words, wouldn't the world have been better off if we did something about Hitler then? rather than letting the war begin. And this is the attitude that I was told existed. And I was also told, as I said, you know, if my story works, we'll have the kind of talk we have from the Pentagon yesterday.
Well, you know, in keeping with what you've been hearing about the president's thoughts about how important it is to take action now and how he compares the president of Iran to Hitler, Robert Baer, a former CIA agent, who his memoir is the basis of the film Syriana, he told you that the president of Iran and his Revolutionary Guard are, quote, capable of making a bomb, hiding it, and launching it at Israel. He says, they're apocalyptic Shiites. These guys are nuts, and there's no reason to back off. So how strong is that feeling, do you think, within the intelligence community, the military, and the Bush White House, that you're dealing with people who are nuts in Iran, and if they get a bomb, the whole world's in trouble, or in the short term, some countries, including Israel, are in trouble, and so we can't back off.
Well, Baer's interesting on that, because Robert Baer spent much of his career, he was an undercover agent, he speaks very good Arabic, and he's one of the few CIA agents who really could live undercover. And one of the things he did, to his enormous credit, was in the 80s, he really pursued the assassination of a man named William Buckley, a CIA station chief who was kidnapped and then killed. He also investigated the Iranian/Hezbollah connection to the bombing of the American embassy and the bombing of the Marines in Lebanon in the early 80s. So, unfortunately, it's his belief that the Revolutionary Guards and the Iranian president, right now Ahmadinejad, were deeply involved in this. And so he comes at it with a very strong point of view that I respect. Having said that, I can also tell you that in my reporting for this story, I spent a lot of time with some of our allies, with those countries who, unlike us, have had diplomatic relationships with Tehran and have done a great deal of research and study and thinking about how that government is run. Now, we're a country that we have not had any diplomatic relations since the Shah was overthrown in, what, 79. But among our allies who have had tremendous contact there and really live there and watch the country, there's a strong belief that the Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader, is really in control, that the Revolutionary Guards, as powerful as they are, and they are getting more powerful, still have to defer to him. And he is a very difficult to understand cleric, power structure in Iraq, in Iran. I read some papers that, I mean, they're just, it's very nuanced how the decisions are made. And when you get beyond just the simple who does what, but the fact is that it's a very pragmatic country. Most people think that despite what the president says of Iran right now, his mouthiness, as I say, this is not Saddam Hussein. They're not interested in being blown up by the United States. They know what the cost of a war would be. They've come to us before. They want to talk to us. They've came in 03 and even talked, so I'm told, about recognizing Israel. What's the price? What can we do? They came and wanted bilateral conversations, which this president will refuse to do. They're still looking for bilateral conversations. Why not talk to the Iranians?
Three retired generals have called for the resignation of Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld: Anthony Zinni, Paul Eaton, and Gregory Newbold. Do you have any idea from all of your sources if that's likely to happen? And how much, also, like, how much discontent is there within the military at Rumsfeld's leadership?
Oh, it's been there for years. Rumsfeld has intervened in the most significant ways. He intervenes in the selection process between who's going to be a three-star general, who's going to be a four-star. Usually secretaries of defense stay out of that business. It's the services business to pick their generals. He intervenes on all levels. He's completely uprooted the host system of the Pentagon in terms of he believes in special forces. He wants his office to have some direct control in running it. He's cutting into the power of the Joint Chiefs and the service secretaries on a number of issues. And so he's pretty much, and he doesn't listen, all these complaints I've been hearing for years. You're hearing them more and more. The three generals who spoke out are just but the tip of an iceberg. Many more inside, for a lot of reasons, don't want to talk. There's a great deal of acrimony, to put it mildly, and it's only getting worse. But he's still Secretary of Defense. You know, in my book, I've been watching these guys since 9/11. You know, writing my little alternative history of this group. And if you think I the key players, of course, are Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld. It's the threesome. There's no way they're ever going to fire Rumsfeld. He's so much more important to them inside than going outside and sniping. They won't have that. He may quit. If he does, it'll be his decision. At the height of Abu Ghraib, as you know, I did a lot of writing on Abu Ghraib. There was a lot of speculation he'd be fired then. I remember telling everybody then, because I know something about how these guys work. No way he's going to be fired. And if you want to know why, it's because this policy is a continuous continuity. What you saw in Abu Ghraib and what you see now, it all comes back to the same small group of people in the White House, the president and the vice president. Rumsfeld is a part of that process.
Any concluding thoughts that you have that you'd like to leave us with?
Yes. One thought that I have, which is this. In all of the conversations I've had about this in the last 3 months, more than that, and hundreds, and all of the talking, the one thing that nobody's ever suggested is that there was any official reckoning or accounting or estimate of how many civilian casualties would be result if we did an all-out bombing or even a partial bombing of Iran, a country with 80 million people, most of whom are instinctively pro-American and anti-cleric. That seems to be just a dreadful, dreadful fact.
Seymour Hersh, thank you very much for talking with us.
Great, Terry.
Seymour Hersh's article about Bush administration plans for a possible airstrike against Iran is in the current edition of The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Betty Crocker in stiletto heels and a leather corset. We consider the mysteries and contradictions in the life of 50s pinup queen Betty Page. Her photos were published in men's magazines like Wink and Bachelor. She also appeared in private bondage films and stills. We talk with director Mary Harron about her new film, The Notorious Betty Page. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Betty Page was a 1950s pinup queen. She posed for men's magazines and for photos and films for private collectors with a taste for leather corsets, whips, black seam stockings, and stiletto-heeled shoes. She's been called the first official pinup of the bondage scene. Her pictures were considered in a 1955 Senate investigation into the impact of pornographic material on youth. She gave up modeling 2 years later and was born again. Her popularity has grown over the years. The mysteries and contradictions of her life are explored in the new movie, The Notorious Betty Page, which stars Gretchen Mol. My guest Mary Harron directed the film. She also made I Shot Andy Warhol and American Psycho and has directed episodes of Homicide, Oz, 6 Feet Under, and Big Love. In this scene from the film, Paige is posing for photos by Paula and Irvin Claw, who run a specialty business. They've asked her to wear black underwear, black seam stockings, and stiletto heels so extreme that she can't walk without assistance. Paula Claw is played by Lily Taylor.
It's the shoes they want.
Shoes and boots and shoes. I can't get enough of them.
Why?
Don't ask. Takes all types to make a world.
What kind of types?
You see, the customers who want this stuff, they're very respectable, very high quality people. Doctors, lawyers, diplomats, even a judge. They're not people like us. The pressures they've got. They're not your average Joe. So what if they want something that seems a little strange, right? If it makes them happy.
Sure.
Sometimes they come into the store and I can see they want something different. Irving says I can spot them a mile off.
Oh, she can. She's got an instinct.
If I think it's shoes they want, I'll pull out a movie star, Lana Turner, let's say, with a nice pair of high heels, and I'll point to them and say, something like this, maybe. Oh, the look on their face, like they're so relieved, I understand. And then I start pulling out the special stuff.
Mary Harron, welcome to Fresh Air. Would you describe the kind of photos and short films that made Betty Page famous?
Well, there are two world Betty Page photographs. One are very sunny, traditional pinups in, you know, bathing suits or bikinis and, you know, kind of jokey, lighthearted. And the other things that made her famous are these fetish photographs that she did for a brother and sister team called Irving and Paula Claw. And these are kind of grainy black and white. And it was seeing these photographs that first kind of inspired my interest in her, because she'll be standing in what looks like somebody's living room, suburban living room, you know, next to a lamp and a table and a chair. And then she's wearing like high heel leather boots and leather corsets. And she's always, you know, some kind of maybe a whip, but she's always smiling radiantly, you know, completely like she's Betty Crocker. She has a completely kind of inappropriate expression for these seemingly sinister photos. So those are the two worlds of Betty Page.
Yeah, in fact, you know, I confess I just bought a DVD of The Real Betty Page at a used record store. And so I was watching some of these films you were just describing with in front of the little lamp and the little table where she's dancing. And it's almost like she's doing a Charleston and a shimmy, you know. I mean, it's...
Yeah,
in all this fetish gear, it's
Yes, I mean, it's really only the fetish gear, or occasionally she will, you know, spank someone kind of ineffectually, or they might do a little bit of wrestling, her and another girl. Always girls, never men in the photos. But apart from that, her demeanor really is of another world. So that's, I think, part of what gives these photos their strange appeal. On the other hand, I think that her affect when she's posing isn't really sexy. It isn't about trying to be sexy. It is the joy of being photographed. It's a kind of very innocent, playful, radiantly happy quality that comes out of the photographs, as if she's a kid dressing up.
Where were her photos published?
Well, when she made them in the early to mid-50s, they were done for private clients who would, the fetish photographs, I mean. And the fetish photographs would be taken in the Claw studio, and, you know, the client would pay for the photographs. He would bring in the very expensive leather outfits, and then there would be for his private collection. Later, some of these were put together in little special editions, you know, Betty Page in Bondage. And the other photographs she did were kind of for the pinup. There were all these pinup magazines with names like Wink, you know, Titter, Flirt. And these were sold on newsstands, and they had a kind of ambiguous status because men would buy them, but then they would keep them under the bed or hide them in the garage. So they were sort of naughty, but not, you know, illegal.
What was your first reaction seeing her photos, and how, if at all, has that reaction to those photos changed?
I think my first reaction was just like, who is this? Where are these photos come from, you know? Because they are kind of erotic. They're strange. You know, there's obviously a darkness because they're this gritty black and white, and because of the fetish content. At the same time, They're so cheery. It just, you know, nothing makes sense, which is kind of Betty herself. You know, she doesn't quite add up as a person. And the more you find out about her, every piece of the puzzle just makes it more mysterious.
Well, you portray Betty Page in your movie as someone who wanted to act but didn't seem to have quite the right talent for theater. But she really came alive doing these erotic poses in front of the camera. I mean, she really came alive. She blossomed. She loved it. Do you see her, you know, in all these kink poses as being like a victim of male lust or somebody who really found her calling?
I would go on the direction of that she really found her calling. I think she was a victim of male lust sometimes in her early life, in her personal life. You know, she had bad sexual experiences. You know, she was abused by her father. She had a very bad rape experience. You know, I think she was someone who had experienced real sexual violence. And so I think if you have had those experiences, to be paid a lot of money just to dress up in costumes with a group of friends, it does not feel like victimization. I don't think it felt like that to her.
Now, in order to make this movie, you had to, in some way, enter the world of fetishists and understand that world so that you could portray them. Do you feel like you understand fetishes for bondage and for stiletto lace-up boots? I mean, one of the Betty Page specialty items were these incredibly high stiletto shoes and boots.
No, you know, it's interesting because there's only a couple of real fetishists in the film. Because Irving and Paula, you know, I think were almost as clueless as Betty and Pat in the sense that they knew that these were for sexual purposes, but they, you know, kind of didn't interest them. They were just wanting to make money and run their business. There's a character called John Willie, who's a real life character played by Jared Harris, who was a really brilliant British artist and photographer who did illustrated stories about young women being, you know, they're very kind of tongue-in-cheek about a young woman named Gwendolyn being tied up by some evil aristocrat. And then he also did a magazine called Bizarre. And Bizarre, you can learn about fetishism from Bizarre. I don't think you can really learn anything about the appeal of fetishism from the Irving and Paula Claw photos because they're kind of clueless. You know, they don't think they understand the erotic content. But when you see John Willie's photographs, you're looking at women through a fetishist's eye. The true fetishist is so obsessive. It's so much about detail. It's so much about the height of the high heel, the length of the stocking top, you know, the number of, you know, laces in the boots. And it is a kind of transference of sexuality, so that the most potent part of the sexuality gets transferred on to high heels, vinyl, rubber boots, you know. I mean, it can be all kinds of things.
There are shots of Betty Page, like the real Betty Page, that are just like her legs and her feet with those shoes on. I mean, that's what I guess the guys wanted to see, the people who were really into those shoes.
Yes, as Lily Taylor, it says in the film, playing Paula Claw, it's shoes and boots and shoes. That's all they care about. It was just something we said constantly on the set. It was our little catchphrase. Things like a high heel fetish seem pretty harmless today, I have to say. Or it certainly seems to me, if somebody wants, you know, to be obsessed with high heels or stocking tops, that's entirely up to them. But I think what the Senate were worried about and the forces of morality generally was an idea that fetishism can be created, that if somebody sees a fetish photograph, it is a kind of infection, and that they, you know, a young person, an impressionable young person, that a fetish can be created in them simply by viewing this material.
One of the things you depict in the movie are these camera clubs where a group of men who are amateur photographers and into pinups would come together and gather in a group and photograph Betty Page or another model. And I don't know whether they had to pay a fee to do this or what, but then they'd be able to take home their photographs and use them however they pleased. What were these camera clubs like, and how did you find out about them?
The photographers did pay a fee, so it was actually very profitable for the models. I first found out about the camera clubs from these fanzines, the Betty Pages, because Greg Theakston, the editor of those magazines, basically interviewed anybody who ever walked across Betty Page's path. And he put us in touch with a lot of, you know, as many photographers as we could talk to who are still alive. And, you know, again, you know, what is racy in the 50s is so innocuous today. I mean, today people make you know, porno movies at home, you know, on home video equipment. But there, to go and you'd pay a substantial amount of money to go and photograph a girl in lingerie. And some people would not even have film in the cameras. They would just pretend to take photographs. So exciting was it to be in the same room as a very curvy girl in underwear.
My guest is Mary Harron. She directed the new film, The Notorious Betty Page. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Mary Harron, and she directed the new film, The Notorious Betty Page. What was the casting process like for you? And one of the things I'm thinking of is that there are so many actresses today who are leading lady kind of actresses who are so thin, and they'd be all wrong for Betty Page, because not that Betty Page was heavy, but she had a figure. She had a bosom. She had hips. She had a kind of hourglass figure. And if you had somebody who looked kind of anorexic with their clothes off, as I think probably a lot of actresses do today, they'd be all wrong.
Yeah, there were some extremely beautiful girls who came in where as soon as I sat down, I was just like, you're never going to play Betty Page. It's just all. And it was both the thinness and actually with some people, it was their body language was all wrong. People would come in and flop and be all relaxed and, you know, the modern manner. But when Gretchen Mol came in, she had deportment. You know, she stood up straight and had her legs crossed. You know, she was like she's wearing white gloves, you know, at the same time that she's, you know, very, you know, adorable and sexy. But she had that, you know, 50s decorum. So there were two things I was looking at, both the right kind of body. I mean, Gretchen is slimmer than Betty. Betty was a curvaceous woman. But I felt like she had the body language so down that she could make it work.
Now the movie shot, there are color sequences, but the movie's largely shot in black and white, so it looks very much of its era, the 1950s. Why did you want to shoot it in black and white?
Well, you know, I never knew why, really. I was just such a deeply held conviction, and many people when we went and pitched the story was like, why? And I have to. You know, the 50s in New York are black and white. I mean, that's certainly how I think of that era. But I realized after we made the film that, of course, the Paula Clough photos are in black and white. And the Bunny Yeager photos that she did in Miami are in color. So that was one reason why I just thought, yeah, New York, black and white. Miami color, because that's how I got to know Betty. But also, I think that there was a good reason for it that I wasn't able to articulate at the time, which was that it gives black and white gives those fetish scenes an aesthetic distance, you know, and also the nude scene. There's a scene with one of the camera clubs early on where she takes all her clothes off, and I want to be very beautiful and kind of not wink wink, you know, more like as she said, as Betty says, you know, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And having it in black and white makes it like another world, the past. And also, you know, to me, one of the main things I wanted to do with this movie was to take you back. I wanted it to be a journey into the past, if it did nothing else. And I think black and white helps to do that.
One of the things that makes the movie very convincing looking is that the faces of the actors and actresses, they look like 1950s faces. And I couldn't explain to you exactly what I mean by that, but they just do, and they're shot in a very 1950s kind of way. Could you talk a little bit about casting for faces that look right for the period?
Yeah, because I care a lot about casting, not just the main roles, but also the extras. And one reason why I was determined to shoot in New York rather than Vancouver or Toronto, which would be cheaper, was that I just don't think you can get New York faces there. I'm from Toronto, so, you know, it's just different. And the other thing I said was to our extras casting, no facial work, no plastic surgery, because that's not period. People in the 50s didn't have their faces done. And then it was really a question of the right faces and then our, you know, fantastic makeup. Our makeup artist, Nikki Lederman, who did such a great job. And then, you know, it was hair, wardrobe. You know, it's production design. But actually, in terms of just shooting the faces, Maud Hopfel, our DP, also used, you know, some period filters. We used a range of lenses that you would only use in 50s movies. There's no long lenses because those came later. We used the lighting of 50s movies, a lot of light, even in the outdoor sequences, to give it that kind of slightly hyperreal quality of old Hollywood. And then we, for Gresham, we also had a thing called the ring light, which is the old Hollywood way of lighting actresses. Because I wanted her always to be like, in an old Hollywood movie, the star is always almost like has a light on her. She's always like glowing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we used an old Hollywood trick, which is a ring light around the camera to cast this even glow on her. So there's a lot went into it.
Do you think that your film, The Notorious Betty Page, has a slightly different point of view with you shooting it as a woman than the point of view that a man shooting it would be likely to have? Is that a fair question?
Oh, yeah. I think it's undoubtedly true. In some ways, I feel it's like the whole point of it. Because I approached her, I think, in a different way. I was not so interested in her being sexy. You know, that wasn't my... I was interested in what it's like to be that kind of girl. What it is like to be a beauty queen. What it is like to be the object of that, you know, that much attention or that gaze. Or, you know, what's it like when your face, your body changes your life in that way? And then what was it for her? What was her experience? That was really... I was just like, you know, let's take her life, her point of view. And I feel like there have been lots of things about beauty icons, but they're not really from their... point of view. It's not about what life is like for them.
You know, as mysterious as it seems, why would somebody be into bondage imagery, you know, and images of women being tied up? I think it's fair to say that, say, in 1950s Westerns, that kind of bondage imagery was a stock part of Westerns. Women were always getting kidnapped and tied up. And, I mean, you could easily argue that 50s Westerns, which children grew up on and everybody watched, were kind of covert bondage imagery.
Yes, and I think Irvin Claw would definitely try to make that case, in fact, in his legal battles. And how that whole business of the Claws came about was that they noticed that people would come in and ask for, you know, Tarzan and the Slave Girl, you know, that photo of her being tied up. That images of women being bound and tied up were very, very popular. And so they realized that there was a special market. I guess they started to specialize and order more, focus on it. And then what's complicated about it is you can see why men, you know, it's dominance of submission. You can see why certain men with kind of S&M tendencies would want to see women bound up. That would play to that fantasy. But then there's also like the female end of it. And I think that Betty Page's popularity kind of reveals the complexity of sexual fantasy, you know, that people imagine themselves in different roles, you know. I mean, even John Willie, you know, the great perv, you know, he liked to be tied up too. He would wear women's stockings, you know. You think of him as, oh, if he likes to photograph women tied up, that means he's one kind of sexual animal. But no, he would wear silk stockings, high heels. He'd like to be, you know, he'd be tied up himself. And people are complicated.
Were there things that you learned about fetishism and different tastes in fetishism that you found just either baffling or fascinating or like, who knew? You know, like, who knew that there was a cult around this item?
Well, actually, years ago was when I first started to hear about this, when I was a young journalist in London. And a friend of mine gave me copies of a British fetish magazine called Atomage, and which was the magazine for vinyl and leather fetishes, and which was hilarious. It was even funnier than the Claws in some ways because it was written from a real English hobbyist's standpoint. It was all about the care and preservation of your leather and vinyl. And it was like they were talking about gardening. It was so British and sort of banal and suburban because, of course, all this stuff is rampant in suburban homes as opposed to, like, you know, supposedly the evil metropolis. I'm sure you probably find that today in America. But anyway, they had the strangest things, which would be like people having fetishes for rubber boots, Wellington boots, and people having fetishes for gas masks, which in, this was many years ago that I looked into this magazine, but this was a kind of a post-war thing that there were all these people who had somehow childhood experiences during the Blitz in Britain with putting on gas masks, and somehow it became a fetish. It's that was the strangest thing I ever encountered. It's like, all right, I would never have thought of that.
Really?
you know, it's like, okay. So anything, you know, anything can somehow become, as they say in the Senate hearings that we, you know, recreate, anything can become a fetish, even a violin. But actually with the claws, you know, with the world of Betty Page, I wasn't really looking that much into fetishism because I wasn't really dealing with the fetishists. I was dealing with the people who create the product. And it's kind of like any kind of filming or any kind of photography. It's like all very, it's a job, you know? And those people, the people who create those sexy images aren't doing it in a sort of atmosphere of sexiness, eroticism. You know, they're just like, okay, you know, well, we need these kind of photographs, 12 copies of this and 8-inch high heels and, you know, move that light and we have to be finished by 5:30.
My guest is Mary Harron. She directed the new film, The Notorious Betty Page. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mary Harron. She directed the new film, The Notorious Betty Page, about the 1950s pinup queen who became famous for posing in leather corsets, whips, and stiletto heels. Betty Page is still alive. Do you know what she's doing now?
Well, she's 83, and I think quite frail. She spends a lot of time signing the many photographs that people, you know, photographs and memorabilia, which she is now able to get some, you know, money out of. She did see the film. It was shown to her at the Playboy Mansion with Hugh Hefner, who's a friend of hers.
What'd she say about it?
Well, I think she liked Gretchen. I think she enjoyed it. I think she found it, you know, when I thought about it, it's like, oh, seeing a film of your own life, it would be so weird and annoying, really, because it's never going to be how you remember it. Because to the point where she said, I wasn't wearing a purple dress. I didn't say that, you know, and I don't blame her. You know, you weren't. You know, it was just, we thought that up. So I think she's still processing it. I think she enjoyed it, except for the Senate hearings, which I think is still a painful subject.
Even though she didn't have to testify at them.
Well, I think it was more what people said about her that she found painful.
What did they say about her at the Senate hearings?
Well, she was used as an example of that, you know, there's this whole thing towards the end of the film where someone, you know, it's a very tragic story that is from the actual transcripts of those hearings, where a young boy was found dead, strangled who tied himself up in ropes. And I believe, and clearly the police then felt that it was autoerotic asphyxiation because they refused to pursue it as a criminal case. But the boy's father was so, you know, racked with grief that he thought, no, it can't have been. It must have been somebody did this to my son. And he found someone showed him some photographs of Betty Page in which she was tied up in a kind of similar pose, and I assume in some classic bondage pose. And these became part of the Senate hearings when they said, you know, this photograph must have caused this boy's death. So it was very, I think, upsetting to her.
So you mentioned that Betty Page is friends with Hugh Hefner, and she saw your film at the Playboy Mansion. Is she still very religious?
Betty is still religious. Of course, she always was. That was one of the things that first intrigued me about her, was that knowing that she was a girl from Nashville who'd been brought up in that kind of Southern religious background, I always thought that she would never have not been religious. You know, she may have been more or less involved with God and more or less involved with the church, but it wasn't like she didn't ever believe in God, you know. But what's interesting about Betty was that she combined her religiousness with an extraordinary kind of free thinking, really. Because even today, she looks back on her pinup career and says, I'm not ashamed of what I did. You know, so people take from religion, you know, people personalize their religion, I think, more than we like to acknowledge. And people take what means something to them. And I think she was not interested in Puritan morality. She wasn't interested in telling other people what to do. You know, I think at heart she was a very tolerant person. She was an open-minded person. And when she went to God, it was more as a refuge and also as I think, being born again, you know, the personal knowledge of Jesus. And after she was born again and attended Bible school, as far as I know, she didn't go around preaching and saying, you know, I have left my sinful life behind. Someone who was in her Bible class who said that he didn't even know much about her previous career. So I think she, you know, so she seems to combine it with the Playboy Mansion and church going, you know, without any big sense of contradiction.
Well, Mary Harron, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Mary Harron directed the new film, The Notorious Betty Page. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Mother-Daughter Wisdom, Understanding the Crucial Link Between Mothers, Daughters, and Health, by Dr. Christiane Northrup. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with a new website at macfound.org. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
When Gerald Ford took over the presidency after the resignation of Richard Nixon, Vietnam was winding down, questions about Watergate remained, and Cold War tensions were high. On the next Fresh Air, Barry Wirth talks about his new book, 31 Days. It covers the transition from Nixon to Ford. Join us for the next Fresh Air.